Hey folks, how are we? Hope you're doing well. Just a quick heads up before we get into today's episode, and that is that Steve and I set out to do one conversation about depression as part of our 101 series. And as we got into it, we just realized that, dude, we have way too much things to say about this topic for it to be just one episode. You know, for anyone who doesn't know, hello, welcome to Mental Health. We do a full intro later. Steve is a clinical researcher. He's a professor. He's a best-selling author. He's been in this game for about 30 years. I've been battling depression for about 15 years. So it's a kind of a beautiful, dark, twisted, eccentric collaboration that we have going on here. But as a result, we've decided to do, like, you know what, clear the schedule. Let's do a full month on the topic of depression. And so welcome to your ears. The first part, this is episode one. And we are so excited to share this with you. I'm trying to keep this super short because we do an intro later on. But just wanted to give you that heads up. Say thank you so much for being here. And we really hope you enjoy this wild adventure that we're about to embark on into one of the biggest, actually scrap that, into the biggest mental health issue of our day. And we're excited, we're hopeful, and we really believe that this has the potential to be a turning point and a bit of a new chapter in your own journey or the journey of someone that you really care about. So yeah, here we go. Thanks for being here, and see you on the other side. So I guess where I wanted to start was, you know, to lean into the pressure and lean into the hype. You know, you've been treating and you've been researching depression for over 30 years. And I know we covered kind of myths in our ADHD episode, but I just wanted to know, like, to lay it on thick to begin with. What is the biggest myth about depression that you've come across in your professional career, Dr. Steve Ilardi?
I'm so happy right now. I love that question. Well, all right. First of all, Hugh, there are so many that it's actually a little painful just to narrow it down to one. But if I got to choose one, it's that so many people out there believe that depression is just about being sad. Okay. Mm-hmm. They think, you know, and you know, people use this language all the time. They'll say, oh, I'm so depressed because my favorite show is off Netflix, or like, right? I'm so depressed because, like, and then fill in the blank with some sling or arrow of outrageous fortune. And here's the deal. The central tragic misunderstanding of depression is the word depression has two completely different meanings. Ooh. depending on the situation. So in everyday conversation, we use the word depression to mean sadness. Full stop. Depression is sadness. So, you know, my show was canceled. My favorite team lost and they were humiliated and I'm depressed. I'm sad about it. And, you know, that's completely normal, understandable. The problem is that the word depression in a clinical setting, in a diagnostic setting, in a medical setting, it doesn't mean sadness. It means this debilitating illness that robs people of their ability to function, robs them of their ability to love and work and play, robs them of their will to live in many cases. So it's about so much more than just being sad. And people get those two confused all the time. It's understandable, but it's tragic.
And it's a really important distinction to make, because there is such a physical component to depression that I actually think, mm-hmm, I only started to unlock even in recent years as I started to become more attuned to, like, what was going on in my body rather than just, like, the, you know, the chaotic whirlwind of, like, thoughts and genuine emotions that you have. And it's so hard to, like, articulate it and put it into words for people that haven't actually experienced it, because their only real point of reference is, okay, I know what it feels like to be sad, but when I'm absolutely sad, I can still get out of bed. So, like, what's your problem, yeah, bro? Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. So listen to this. I ran into a guy some years ago who put this whole thing into perfect perspective. So this young man had battled cancer. He had Hodgkin's lymphoma, really serious form of cancer. He went through chemo. He lost his hair. He's projectile vomiting. It was horrible. And while he suffered from cancer. All of his friends, his family, they were there for him. They understood it. They rallied around. And he was suffering, but he understood it. And he made a complete recovery. He went into remission. But then several years later, he became clinically depressed. And he was telling me about this experience after he'd recovered. And he said, Steve, listen, having been through cancer and chemo and having been through clinical depression, he's like, if I had to have one again, I would take the cancer in a heartbeat, hands down, no question. He's like, cancer, chemo absolutely sucked. It was horrible. But depression is like orders of magnitude worse. Because when I was depressed, I was suffering, not just pain. And he's like, I couldn't even point to where the pain was in my body, but it hurt. It hurt everywhere. It hurt in my soul. And here's the thing. Nobody could see it. And I couldn't articulate it. When I was projectile vomiting, everybody could see it. They knew I was hurting. They were there for me. They understood it. Hey, guess what? Not a single person when I was battling cancer was like, hey, let's try to just help you snap out of it. Hey, let's go do this fun thing. That'll make it all better. Hey,
have you tried this thing called willpower to treat your cancer? You should really try it. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's like, man, are you just like some slacker? No. But when I had depression, nobody could really understand, or very few people could really understand it. And so I'm dying on the inside. I don't even want to go on living, and I can't explain it. Nobody can understand it. And he's like, I literally thought it would never end. I gave up hope. And when I was battling cancer, I never for a second gave up hope. I always believed I was going to get well.
Wow.
When he said this to me, well, first of all, I mean, there were tears in my eyes because it was so powerful and so poignant. But it was like, okay, I am never going to forget this moment. Because if anyone ever has any doubt about how serious clinical depression is, this should remove every trace of doubt.
And something that I'm really excited about doing this show, and just in general, like the fact that mental health issues like depression are getting a little bit more airtime, and the vocabulary is like more in the general public, even amongst like school kids and workplaces and all that sort of stuff. Because my experience was, you know, my first depressive episode, I was around 11, and actually we can get into later kind of what triggered it, because it ties into some of the things we want to say. But, you know, it was, I probably was only like 16, 17 whenever I started to actually get the language of like, oh, that thing that you're experiencing is called depression. And so, like, you know, for years I'm going through and I'm battling this absolute unknown dragon and feeling like, what the heck is wrong with me? Like, is there something legitimately like just broken in who I am? And I'm so excited that fewer and fewer people will go through that unknown aspect to it as we start to kind of give people language, because language is so powerful. Because once you have a little bit of language for something, you realize you're not alone. You realize that there's other people you can relate to. And then ultimately, you also find that incredible amount of hope where you're like, oh my goodness, like there are treatments and things that I can do. But if you don't know you're battling with depression, there's no way you'll ever find, you know, your book, The Depression Cure. So that kind of diagnosis or that discovery of what it is that you're actually feeling and putting words to it is definitely the first step.
Knowledge is power.
Dude, absolutely.
Yeah.
So yeah, look, cool. I just want to say hello and welcome to Mental Health, the podcast where we discuss the latest tools, cutting-edge research, and the ancient practices to help you take back control of your emotional well-being. We're really glad that you're here. We really hope that you've been enjoying the show so far. You've been listening for a while. And if this is your first time, we're thrilled that you've joined us for this episode. We're really excited about it. We think it's going to be a really important one. And it's important for me. My name's Hugh James. I'm a podcaster and writer from Northern Ireland. And my journey is totally, as I've already mentioned, been around this area of depression over the last 15 years. And met Steve a few years ago after reading his book that I mentioned. And it was a significant kind of life-changing and turning point in my battle with depression. So yeah, we really appreciate you spending this time with us, and we hope that today is beneficial for you.
Thanks, Hugh. Yeah, and so I'm Steve Ilardi, and I'm a psychologist, I'm a researcher, I'm a writer, and more than anything else, I'm a fellow traveler with all of you. We're passionate about the fact that mental health is the single most important foundation that any of us can lay for living our best possible life. So really, our mission, every episode, it's to help you feel more informed, more empowered, more encouraged on your own journey.
Absolutely. So today's episode, it's our fourth installation of the Mighty 101 series, where Steve and I have been tackling and doing a deep dive on some of the most common mental health issues that our world faces today. So far, it's actually really cool to see like how we're rattling through these. Like, it's like slow in the week by week, but then you look back and you're like, whoa, this is like the fourth one already. So we've done ADHD, yeah. We've done anxiety, we've done addiction, now we're on to depression. And the whole idea is that along the way, we want to help lay out what causes these issues. And most importantly, like, what are some of the practical steps, the treatments, the cures that we can all take to better equip ourselves or the people that we care about most and arm ourselves with tools, weapons, whatever language you want to throw on it against these very, very common and really human realities that we can often find ourselves in. So I would like to kind of pick up where we left off. I'd like to kind of zoom in a little bit. I'm like, it's the audio show, but I'm like, you know that like pinch movement you do on like an iPad to like zoom in?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm literally doing this. Let's zoom in a little bit on like the distinction between depression and sadness. Because if I like rock up to a doctor's office or like, I don't know, like a psychologist and I tell them I'm sad, how do they then like distinguish between depression and sadness? Like, how does it work from a diagnosis perspective?
Yeah. So several times now in our series, we've talked about the fact that we've got this diagnostic Bible, the DSM-5. It's what we use in the fields, what everyone uses pretty much, to have just a formula for making a diagnosis of any psychological disorder, any form of mental illness. Now, we got a formula for clinical depression. First of all, the technical diagnostic term is MDD, major depressive disorder. And to get that diagnosis, major depression, major depressive disorder, the person has to have an episode of clinical depression. And that episode is diagnosed on the basis of 9 core symptoms. We'll cover them in a minute. DSM says, look, here are the 9 symptoms. We're going to talk about them. If you have at least 5 or more, and people usually have more than 5, but if you have 5 or more of these and they last for 2 weeks or longer in a stretch and you got them most of the day, nearly every day, 2 weeks or more, they knock out your ability to function in a significant way, you qualify for the diagnosis. Now, for most people, the symptoms go a lot longer than 2 weeks, usually at least a few months, but even just 2 weeks, even 2 weeks can be devastating.
Totally.
And so we want to make the diagnosis as quickly as we can. All right. So what is it? Okay. Should we just like take a quick run through the 9 core symptoms?
Yeah, I think it would be very helpful. I also had a really bad joke there while you were talking. I was like, yeah, a depressive episode is like my least favorite podcast ever. I think I might cut that, but I just said it. I had to get it out of
no. Somebody was telling me about listening to our pod the other day. I think it's one of our 5 listeners, and they were.
Thanks, Mom.
they were like they're like, it's amazing that you and Hugh are able to talk about such really, really poignant, serious issues and yet do it with a light touch and with a kind of intrinsic humor and camaraderie. And I was like, you know what, man, every clinician develops a kind of dark humor, and suffering is never funny.
Okay, but what I was literally about to say to you is I think the reason why we've clicked from day one is because Irish humor is as black as it gets. And like, totally get the whole like using humor to endure suffering and to like, you know, just get through a hard time. And so I think because you'd built that up, you know, I don't know, we've joked before, like, you know, where you grew up, you also kind of had like long winters and stuff like that. So we probably shared in our humor bones. But yeah, look, I think the black humor is, it's so, so important. And hopefully it gets people through the episodes.
Absolutely. So dear listener, we are occasionally going to go to some very serious and dark places.
Yeah, for sure.
And yet we want you to join us on that journey in a way that feels not only bearable, not only endurable, but like, hey, you know, if we get through this together, then we're going to need to find the dark humor along the way. And sometimes it won't even be so dark, right? We're going to be talking about things on the pod that are a lot lighter.
Often it's just dad humor.
That's the problem. We both have a lot. Yeah. Not today. All right. So 9 core diagnostic symptoms of depression. So what are they? How do we make the diagnosis? So number one, there is very often a loss of interest or a loss of pleasure in our typical usual activities, okay? So the things that I used to enjoy, I don't even enjoy them anymore. Mm. There is actually a syndrome that's part of this. I love these really awesome technical Latin-derived terms. You know I love Latin. Anhedonia. Which literally just means the inability to experience pleasure. And so for a lot of people with depression, their pleasure circuits just go completely offline and nothing registers. They lose their sex drive. Food doesn't even taste good anymore. Oh, and the biggest manifestation is social interaction. People start to withdraw from the social world around them. And it's a really, really big red flag for clinical depression. That's symptom number one.
Have you ever seen Pirates of the Caribbean?
I've seen clips. I've seen clips.
Come on, dude.
I am not fully literate in the mores of pop culture. I'm sorry.
Okay, anyway, you haven't seen it, but hopefully like somebody listening can relate to it. But it's called The Curse of the Black Pearl, and it's basically about these pirates who stole this like forbidden gold. Classic storytelling 101. You know, there always has to be forbidden gold. And
always.
They get immortality, so they live forever. And as a pirate, that's awesome. You can go, you can steal as much stuff as you want, and I think it's great. They don't realize that the drawback is that they don't feel anything. So they're, you know, these hedonistic pirates, and it's in the word, anhedonia.
Yeah,
they can't experience anything. They can't experience the taste of wine. They can't experience the taste of food. They can't experience, you know, physical touch or anything. And there's this amazing bit, like the guy's name's Captain Barbossa, and I think he's got this like Scottish accent. And he's like, the food turned to ashes in our mouths. We can't taste the smell of wine anymore. Can't taste the smell of wine. Anyway, you get the idea. And they are in this place where the whole movie is about them like trying to trade back their immortality just to feel something again. And okay, like it's Disney,
okay,
it's Pirates of the Caribbean, but I'm like, do you know what, dude? That is how I feel whenever I'm in a depressive episode. It's like I would trade everything just to get that numb feeling to go away, you know? And things that you love, like I love nature, like I'm a big outdoors guy. I love going for a walk in the park. And like when that kind of black dog comes, as we refer to it over here, like, I just don't even want to go out. And I'm like, dude, like, what the... And it's a good kind of tell or a good sign for me. I'm like, dude, if you don't even want to do that, like, you probably need to have a little honest conversation about what's happening to you right now, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's so beautifully put. And I feel like I owe you just a little bit of an apology, because when you started talking about the pirates, I'm like, what the hell, man? Like,
I mean, that's most of my anecdotes are like some weird obscure reference, and I can just hear your eye roll, like, or not even eye roll, it's more like, oh dear God, please bring it back, please bring it back. I believe you haven't seen it, dude. That's your homework for next episode.
I'm on it.
The first one is incredible. The subsequent like 10 movies or whatever it is are not that great, but number one.
I'll watch the first one. Yeah, got it. Okay. All right. So we just did number one here of 9 core diagnostic symptoms. That's loss of interest or pleasure. Number two. Okay. This one is no big shocker. Second symptom, depressed mood. Now, I know I just said a minute ago that clinical depression is not really about depressed mood, but it often does, in fact, have depressed mood. But here's what I got to say about that. This is not just being down, just being sad. It is very, I mean, I've worked with hundreds of patients with clinical depression. Most of them describe something, it's like an oppressive emotional pain. It's a type of agony. It's a type of suffering. It's not, oh, I'm sad. It's like this deeply hurts. And so I just think it's really important to be clear about that. Yes, depressed mood is part of the diagnosis, but it's amplified and it's only one part of it.
That word oppressive, I think, is so powerful there. I've never heard it used in this context. And it's just mm-hmm. that, like, an image in my head of just like having something literally like pressed down on top of you. You know, people talk about feeling heavy. And yeah, that's, I really like how you said that.
Okay. So, third symptom, fatigue. And we're talking, in most cases, crushing fatigue. The person with clinical depression is just like, look, I don't have the energy. I don't have the bandwidth. All I want to do is basically just try to get through my day. I'm exhausted all the time. Everything feels like an effort. And God forbid that I have to actually initiate something, right? It's just like, I can react, I can respond. I can't initiate. And it's just crushing fatigue all the time.
Like, the way I would describe it is, it's a little bit like when you have the flu. Like that kind of like achy pain sort of thing. Oh, yeah. In one of our COVID episodes, I think I mentioned, like, having COVID kind of felt like having depression without having the low mood. You know what I mean? Like that, climbing the stairs is really hard right now, but actually I'm not quote unquote sad.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's really well put. Okay. So now let's turn to another really important symptom where there's a lot of misunderstanding. So it has to do with sleep disturbance. And, you know, I think most of the lay public, when they think about depression, they're like, so if you're depressed, you sleep all the time. You never want to get out of bed. And it is true that probably, from the best estimate, about 20%, about 1 in 5 people with depression, they have what we call hypersomnia. They sleep way too much. But they're sleeping like 9, 10, 11 hours, 12 hours. But it's not restful. It's not restorative. So it's like they're craving that sensation of being rested, but they're never getting it. Most people with depression, though, it goes the other way. They have insomnia. They have trouble. Mm-hmm. The most common form of insomnia is the person is just like waking up all the time. And then in particular, waking up like way too early, like a few hours too early, and they cannot get back to sleep. We call that terminal insomnia because it comes at the terminus or the end point of their sleep cycle. And super, super common in depression.
And I feel like there maybe can be like a bit of a weird mix between the two where you're maybe oversleeping a lot, where, you know, maybe you get up at 7 o'clock in the morning usually. And then for some reason, you know, over the course of a week, you get up at like 10 o'clock and then 3 days later, you get up at like 2 p.m. So then you all of a sudden shift to this like nocturnal sort of lifestyle.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean? So then you're actually, you're awake at nighttime and you're starting to sleep during the day. I don't know why, but it's strange how you can kind of spiral that direction.
Absolutely. Yeah. In fact, let's talk about that later because what you just talked about is a shift in the body clock or in circadian rhythms. That's a really important potential trigger for depression and potential consequence as well. Okay. So next symptom, we talked about changes in sleep, and very commonly with change in sleep goes a change in appetite, and that can also be accompanied by changes in weight. And again, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, if you're depressed, you're going to be eating a lot, comfort foods, maybe. And we do see this. We especially see it in seasonal depression, winter onset depression, where people have a lot of carb craving or junk food craving while they're depressed. But the most common, believe it or not, the most common manifestation is people lose their appetite and they lose weight when they're depressed. And again, it can go either way. It can even toggle within the same person over the same episode. But the key here is appetite change.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think a lot of us will kind of use food as a coping mechanism or like a comfort as well. It's very much in the culture. So if you're anyway that way inclined, you know, it's an easy kind of thing to turn to, I think, whenever you are feeling depressed.
Absolutely. But beyond that, you know, people have these like intense cravings sometimes that it's beyond just like, oh, I want a comfort food. It's like their appetite is voracious and they're craving specific. Yeah.
Before I kick sugar, like I would like go through like packets of biscuits, like nobody's business, like just an unreasonable amount of biscuits.
and for our American audience that I'm going to translate for Hugh, that's a cookie. Biscuits are cookie.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not like with gravy, you absolute savages.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 I love it. Okay. Next symptom. This has got one of those really fancy technical sounding names. Psychomotor retardation, which is a fancy way of saying when people are depressed, they very often will slow way down. And you might think, well, if you're fatigued, you slow down. No, this is beyond that. This is like your rate of speech slows down. Your volume of speech gets lower. Your movements slow down. Everything is like in slow motion. And I'll tell you, again, having worked clinically with hundreds of folks with depression, it should have been part of my training, probably. Nobody ever pointed this out. But I started noticing that the very first minute of a new session, when my patient would walk in, I was using their level of retardation. So the speed of their speech, the strength of their voice, the speed of their walking and their movements, that was my gauge, my symptom gauge for how much improvement are we seeing this week? I could tell instantly. And I mean, at a high level of reliability, just from noting the rate of psychomotor retardation.
There's a really interesting AI tech startup waiting to happen there that measures patients' Absolutely. Speaking, their tone and words per minute, and then crunching the data. Oh, no, I said, I nearly said data. I thought I did say it, but I'm so glad I said data.
you know what? We'll accept either version. I think you're absolutely onto something. Here's the deal. All of us with our loved ones, we kind of know what their sick voice sounds like. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Like, it's like, oh, that's their sick voice. Mm-hmm. And their voice is the timbre changes, and it's a little weaker, and it's a little raspier, and it's not about congestion. It's just like the rate, the quality of vocal emanations changes. And that's part of what we see in depression, which is, by the way, is a huge hint that we're talking about an illness. We're not talking about a mood per se.
And I can actually give it to you from the other side of the table. I remember, very early on, maybe when I was 13 or 14, I remember going to see a school counselor, being forced to go to a school counselor.
And yeah, that's always a lovely experience.
Yeah. And I remember the sessions that I would be depressed. Yeah, I would be the classic one word answers or just hardly even speaking. And then, fast forward a few months and I would be feeling fine and I'd be all talk, all chat, practically doing a podcast with a counselor. And so it's crazy. I've never actually thought about that this could actually be an actual symptom of depression itself. So cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's fantastic. So next symptom, and I'm going to use a term the DSM doesn't use, but I'm going to call it cognitive deficits. Okay. So the DSM focuses on two, but basically depression affects our ability to think clearly. And what the DSM hones in on is difficulty concentrating. So this feeling like I can't focus, I can't lock in, I can't concentrate, and difficulty with being able to make decisions, a kind of odd, bizarre indecisiveness. With so many patients, when they're battling depression, they'll talk about this. Now, there are literally a dozen other manifestations of brain fog and impaired thinking that we could talk about, but these are the two that DSM locks in on. I'm fine with it. I mean, I might have thrown in memory impairment as well, or maybe instead, but anyway, cognitive deficits.
The decision-making thing is so key, and I know I'm getting ahead of myself slightly, but this is why I'm a big advocate for having some sort of a system in place that you prepare ahead of time before you go into a dip. I usually refer to it as a dip because even in the moment, something simple like, okay, I know I should exercise. Okay, what type of exercise should I do? And you can really be standing there for 5 minutes, not being able to think how should I move my body right now? Versus I know exactly what to do. I'm going to put these shoes on. I'm going to go on this short walk. And let's just don't even think about it. Let's just do it,
Absolutely. So we just talked about how depression can affect our ability to think clearly. But there's another angle on it. So there's another symptom. And it has to do with this crazy distortion in thinking that depression does. So basically, depression makes us see the world through this negative black dark filter, these negative thoughts. And DSM really hones in on two of them. Again, there are a lot more that we could talk about, but the two that are diagnostic are feeling worthless, just a sense of like, I'm this worthless human being, and excessive guilt, just this feeling of like, oh, I've really screwed up and I'm a burden to people around me. And, you know, I just want to crawl into a hole somewhere and not have to face people.
Yeah.
But negative thinking is just so central to the experience of depression.
And I know it's not in DSM, but like I would just add to that, like this profound sense of shame, you know, like this feeling that like it's my fault, or, you know, like I'm a bad person. Like this is why I feel like this. And I've talked to so many people who experience depression, and they say that that is one of the most painful aspects to it. It's just this feeling of like aggressiveness towards yourself, like your own person. And I guess that ties into the last one ultimately.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the final symptom, the ninth in our list, is thoughts about death, thoughts about suicide. And, you know, we're going to have a whole episode on this just to sort of bookmark this. We need to take a deep dive into understanding suicide, preventing suicide, how to be there, how to recognize some of the warning signs. We're going to do that. But for today, we just want to mention, as I said earlier, depression is incredibly painful. And when a person is suffering, when they're in pain and they have the negative thinking, so they get really hopeless and they're like, okay, I'm hurting and this is never going to get better, which by the way is false, but they can't see that, right? I mean, depression, thank God, one of the things we're going to talk about is it almost always does lift, and it's treatable, it's curable, but in the moment, it definitely doesn't feel that way. So what happens? People are like, well, I need an escape. And if I'm suffering and this is never going to get better, then, well, maybe death is an escape. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people with depression start to fantasize about their own death. Now, many of them, thank God, will say, well, look, I'm not going to end my life. I would never do that and you can think of many different reasons why somebody would be like, I'm never going to take my own life. But like, if a bus hit me, if I had an aneurysm, if I stroked out, you know, that would be great because then I wouldn't be in pain. And we still call that suicidal ideation. It's just, it's passive now. It's not active. It's like, I wish I were dead. And that's extremely common. We see it in the majority of cases of clinical depression. And so, you know, we just want to validate that is, not only is it a part of the syndrome, it is part of the diagnosis of clinical depression.
Absolutely. And there's so, I'm trying to even think like what I want to say right now. Like there's so much that I'd love to say. And I really look forward to that Suicide 101 episode. Actually, I think it's going to be really, really important. But I guess just like one quick thought is, if you look at all living, I don't know, forms of life, that's a bit clunky, but we'll roll with it. Like the number one goal is to stay alive. You know, like that is like at the core what life wants to do. Any animal on the planet, any near organism on the planet, even a virus like COVID, its goal is to keep on going. And so the thought that like you would have a desire or even an idea that you would like to end your life, I think just speaks volumes to the completely twisted nature of depression, and that it is, it totally goes against every single cell in your body almost for you to even have those sort of thoughts. And that's how kind of disorderly, I guess, the disorder is.
It's honestly one of the central reasons why I'm so passionate about working to heal depression, working to validate like this is genuine suffering, but it is not forever. And it is treatable. And I've just had the incredible privilege of working with so many people who not only, you know, wanted to end their lives, but I've worked with a few who had a plan, who had the means, who were in the middle of implementing the plan, and who had made me a promise that they would get in touch before they ended their life. And they did, thank God. I've also lost people that I really cared about.
Yeah.
To suicide.
Me too.
And it's it's agonizing. And it's unspeakably tragic. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Hugh and I are going to circle back to this, but what we're going to say right now is, you know, we're going to put some resources up on the show notes. If you are in that dark place, if that's something that you're thinking about, or if you have somebody in your life that's in that dark place, there are resources available. There are so many people that care and that will move heaven and earth to help, not only help keep you alive, but to help you get to a place where you want to stay alive. So I think can we just leave it at that for right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for me, like, the crazy thing about all nine of those symptoms is that you can feel them and experience them even if everything in your life is going great. Like, you could literally have it all. You could have no negative life circumstances going on. You could have all the money in the world. You could have all the relationships in the world, and you could still feel all nine of those things, or, you know, at least even a handful of them. And that it's just one of the crazy natures of the disease. And, you know, it's not an exhaustive list. Like, I'm sure you'd agree, like, there's more symptoms there, but it's interesting that that's what the clinicians are looking at.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that's a really important caveat. There are lots of other symptoms of depression that we could have talked about. Hopelessness, for example, memory problems. There are dozens, but, you know, these nine, I think they're fine. They've been with us for 50 years. They're a decent representative sample for diagnostic purposes. We're not going to miss anybody because we have worthlessness instead of hopelessness, right?
I mean, it's a pretty broad umbrella. Like, it covers a lot of ground there. Like, you probably heard me throughout being like, yep. One question I did have exactly. was, like, I have heard of situations where, like, depression is caused by, like, another medical condition, or, like, even as like a side effect to some drugs, or, like, even after, like, birth. Obviously postpartum is a big thing. So, like, if I rock up to the doctor, say, in that scenario, am I going to be put in just the depressive box and put on that kind of, like, treatment conveyor belt, or is it treated differently?
That question makes me so happy. That's such a great question. Okay, so first things first, it is absolutely the case that depression is sometimes secondary to another medical condition. Like what? Like hypothyroidism, like sleep apnea, like cancer even can be. When it's clear that somebody has, like we said, sleep apnea, and their depression developed after that, like, we say, okay, this is not major depressive disorder. This is a depression, quote, secondary to another medical condition. And it's just a way of reflecting, like, okay, in those cases, we can do everything right treatment-wise, but if we miss the underlying medical condition that's driving it, then we may not get the person completely well. Right. And similarly, there are lots of drugs, many that are prescribed, like what? Well, antibiotics like Cipro, acne medications like Accutane, even hormonal birth control in some cases can trigger an episode of depression. But in that case, again, we want to say, well, this is medication-induced mood disorder. It's not just run-of-the-mill depression. Why? Because in that case, if we leave the person on the drug that's driving their depressive syndrome, anything else we do is probably not going to be fully effective. So, so we absolutely want to make those. We want to make those kind of catches. We've got all these rule outs that we need to be thinking about clinically. And unfortunately, you know what often happens is somebody has their depression driven by an illness. They have their depression driven by a drug, or maybe something they're using recreationally, like an opiate or something. And we don't make the catch. And now we're like, oh, well, they have a quote chemical imbalance, and we'll circle back to that. But like, oh, let's throw these medications at it. And then we shrug and say, ah, wow, this is a treatment resistant depression. It's not getting better. It's like, well, you know what? We got to do our diagnostic work. We got to really treat this illness like something that has many possible different causes. And I know we're just about to talk about causes, but it also has different subtypes. You mentioned postpartum. There's also seasonal onset depression. There's depression that occurs in the context of bipolar illness. And so a lot of the same treatments, it turns out, are still useful for those different subtypes, but they have some different implications. Hopefully we'll clear up some of that ground. We'll shed some light on some of that ground in part two.
So, I mean, let's launch straight into the, we've done pretty well. This is the first reoccurring question that we've used in this episode. And whenever we look at all the other episodes in the series, we are really wanting to look at the causes. We're really wanting to look at the superpowers. And a question that I've asked you, I think probably in every single one of these one-on-one episodes so far is...
Every time.
Yeah.
Like, every time.
This idea of, like, I don't know, natural selection or like... evolutionary progress or hunter-gatherer community, something in that ballpark. But like, why did depression not just get naturally selected out of humanity? Because it does not seem like it's a useful tool for us to have. And so why Absolutely. Did it not just kind of get debugged out of the system? Like, why is it still here?
I know. It's such a huge mystery. And I'm really glad you asked it that way, because... literally 20 years ago, I can remember kind of metaphorically, by the way, banging my head against the wall and just like, okay, look, depression, by the way, we haven't mentioned this yet, but depression is now the single leading cause of global work-related disability.
Whoa.
Depression is one of the leading causes of death through depression-linked suicide. It's a cause of extraordinary suffering, as we've mentioned. But, I mean, it is not the sort of thing, given that it can kill people, given that it is horribly disabling because of its impact on our ability to function. I mean, take it one step further from an evolutionary standpoint. It interferes with our reproductive fitness, right? Because, you know, part of depression is we lose our sex drive, we lose our desire to be around other
people.
That's
what I mean. It's literally like life's job to procreate. Like, why does this bug still in the software?
And survive. Yeah. Okay. So let's break it down. What I realized 20 years ago is like, all right, what's universal? I mean, if something is an adaptation, it's going to be universal. And sadness and grieving are universal. Mm-hmm. So when we look at even... Aboriginal groups around the world. And I think we can learn so much from studying people like the Kaluli and the Kungsan and the Chimane, modern day Aboriginal groups who live largely the way our ancestors did for hundreds of thousands of years back in the Pleistocene, back in the Stone Age, hunter gatherer groups. We find, you know, they have all the same emotional responses we do. That's standard, off the shelf, hardwired human nature. It is human nature to get sad, to experience emotional pain when life serves us up something painful. You know, when we have a loss, when we have a failure, when we have a setback, when we have a disappointment, emotional pain is there to serve a similar kind of function and signal as physical pain, right? We need physical pain. We don't like it, but we can't live without it. We need that information, that signal of like, hey, you're going to do tissue damage if you keep this up. Like, you need to drop everything you're doing and pay attention to the pain right now so you can fix this, and then we can move on. Same with emotional pain. Something really horrible has happened. You just had this really agonizing breakup. It's like, all right, well, that needs to get your attention. You need to figure out, like, all right, is this fixable? If no, well, now what? How can you move forward? What can you learn from it? How can you make sure this doesn't happen again, right? Emotional pain, if we didn't have it, we would be so much worse off. And people who, we talked about this in the anxiety fear episode, but people who cannot experience emotional pain often end up dead prematurely, because pain is our friend when it's a true signal. The problem is people that get a false signal. I'll give you an analogy that helps me a little bit. So our ability to gain weight, turns out, hey, that's a really cool evolutionary adaptation. The ability to gain weight for our ancestors was absolutely critical. Obviously, during childhood, kids need to take in a lot more calories than they're expending so they can gain weight and grow. And then in adulthood for our ancestors, like our adipose fatty tissue was their savings account. If they had food surplus, yeah, hell yeah. They need to put on extra calories. They need to gain some weight because that's a buffer.
Yeah. How else are you going to get through winter, man?
Exactly.
You need that tire around your stomach because it's just, there's your calories in cold storage.
Well, and we see this even today with, you know, people that are in their 80s and 90s. If they get really frail, many of them are dangerously underweight. And we find, you know, if granny can put on an extra 10 pounds, like that could be the difference between living or dying the next time she's in the hospital with pneumonia, the next time she has an infection, the next time she has if she breaks her hip, God forbid, you know. So we need to be able to gain weight. That's an adaptation. That's evolved. But obesity is not something that evolved. It's not an adaptation. We don't see hunter-gatherers getting clinically obese. Why? Obesity is the result of a mismatch. It's an artifact of a mismatch between our Stone Age genes, which absolutely crave sweet, calorie-dense, hyper-palatable, sweet, salty, starchy foods that are now available 24/7, 365, caloric abundance, hyper-palatable. Our Stone Age genes have very little resistance against the modern dietary caloric environment. And as a result now, I cannot believe I'm going to spout this figure, but here we go. 70% of American adults are now clinically overweight. 70%. And nearly 40% are actually diagnostically obese. So, you know, overweight at a level that it's now really medically harmful. Again, it's not something we were evolved to be. We're never evolved to become obese. We were evolved with appetites that worked really, really well in the ancestral environment. And now in the modern environment, they don't work at all. They don't serve us. Our ability to get sad, our ability to grieve, that's a great adaptation. We need it. All of us need it. But in the modern environment, which has so many toxic features and is now lacking so many of the things that protected our ancestors, now we have an epidemic of depression where, by the best estimates, probably today's young people, so millennials, Gen Z, they seem to have a projected lifetime risk of depression somewhere between 30 and 40% of this debilitating illness that, you know, can be life-threatening. It's absolutely staggering. And it's not something that we were evolved to have.
So basically what you're saying is, let's say the last 100 years,
mm-hmm.
the way we as humans lived our lives changed so much that our bodies didn't have a chance to evolve and adapt to it. And then that's what you mean by a mismatch. We still have like pretty much like if you were to look at like Hugh James in like 1894 and Hugh James today, like on a biological level, they're probably exactly the same, other than like 1894 Hugh was probably a lot more ripped and strong.
I mean, it's really interesting if you look at it's a challenge to study the rates of depression in hunter-gatherers and the rates of depression in like the Amish, right? The American Amish, who are still living largely like all of our Western ancestors did a couple hundred years ago, very agrarian, low-tech, pre-industrial. How about that? Pre-industrial lifestyle. Best estimate is the Amish, they definitely can get clinically depressed, but probably about 10 times less likely.
Wow.
So our rates of depression are probably about, you know, an order of magnitude, about 10 times higher. That's huge. The hunter-gatherers that have been studied are probably about 100 times lower risk.
Whoa.
For 100 to 1,000 times lower risk than we are for clinical depression. So, you know, absolutely this very recent transition from an agrarian way of life, you know, pre-industrial, no electricity, just living with the rhythms of nature. Yeah, there's some civilization, but again, you know, very low tech. That transition over the past century or two to the current 2022 post-industrial landscape has been absolutely devastating to our psychological and physical well-being.
Awesome stuff. Hi, it's me again. you're like, wait, what the heck's happening? No, it's me from the future. I'm back again. The same version of Hugh that did the intro. You know, it's been like 30 or 40 minutes for you guys. It's been like 30 seconds for me. So it's a little bit disorientating to try and come back and like, you know, try to get in the same kind of like mindset and frame of mind to end an episode that a previous version of you was a part of in the past. Anyway, my head's starting to get fried. All that to say, thank you for being here. I really, really hope you enjoyed part one. Hope you found it beneficial. We are really, really excited about this series. Honestly, we put our hearts and our souls into this one. Like, we really, really went to town and are so excited to share the second part of it with you next week, where we're diving into the causes, the cures. We talk a lot about this idea of the chemical imbalances. What? Does that exist? Does a chemical imbalance even mean anything? Is that a scientific term? Was it maybe invented by marketers? Spoiler alert. But if you would like to check that episode out, we really encourage you to subscribe wherever you're listening to today's podcast, whether it be Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Audible, or the list goes on and on and on. Also, quick shout out to all of the people a part of our Patreon community. I want to give a genuine big thank you to all of the supporters who make this show possible. Patreon is a crowdfunding platform. It allows people just like you who listen to podcasts like this and who hopefully enjoy it and who have the means to support it for as little as the price of a cup of coffee every single month. And that just means that we can stay independent. It means we can stay ad-free. It allows us to continue doing this show. And we really appreciate all of you who've partnered with us in our mission to provide free, high quality mental health educational content for people all over the world. It is crazy how many people listen to the show and where they listen from. And so we really appreciate those of you who pick up the tab for, you know, the majority of people. And I genuinely mean that, like, thank you, thank you, thank you. And if it's something that you would consider doing, you would like to explore what it would mean to do that and join our private community, you can do so over at patreon.com/mentalhealthpodcast. As a way to say thank you, we will actually give you the full list of episodes in this series. So all four parts of the depression deep dive that we're doing, you can listen to it right now over on our Patreon as just a way to say thank you to our supporters. Other than that, really hope you have a great rest of your week. And I look forward to, and I can speak on behalf of Steve as well, we look forward to touching base with you next week where we dive into part two. Awesome. Cheers.